Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, we have bad, and we have crazy martinis for conservatives today. And just to clear the air, Jim, I think it's important that we tell our listeners that nothing is final in terms of us replacing Megyn Kelly in the 9 o'clock slot for Fox News, although if they're still willing to pay $20 million for the slot, I think you and I'd be willing to split that. I don't know.
I would do it even for a quarter of that. A great bargain at that. Yeah, boy, I don't know about you. Greg, does it feel like you've seen an enormous number of people pretty much openly campaigning for the job?
That's amazing.
It's like the Denver Broncos coaching gig.
Yeah, there's a lot of opinions about who should get that slot. I have more opinions on who shouldn't than who should. But we'll see what they decide over there. A lot of eyes on what happens at Fox now that Megyn Kelly's gone to NBC. But she is none of our martinis today. We start with the good martini. And the good news is there's still a vacancy on the Supreme Court that Barack Obama didn't fill. The magical five-minute recess appointment did not happen yesterday as the Senate was temporarily in between different Congresses. But Politico is reporting that the Trump transition, soon to be the Trump administration, is already whittling down the list of who it plans to have the president nominate once he is actually in office to replace the late Antonin Scalia. Politico reporting pretty extensively on this, and it reports, quote, two of the most discussed names are Diane Sykes of the Chicago-based Seventh Circuit Federal Appeals Court and William Pryor of the Atlanta-based 11th Circuit, in part because Trump himself name-dropped them at a primary debate last February. Both are on the public list of 21 judges that Trump pledged during the campaign that he will select from. Other names reportedly on the short list include 3rd Circuit Judge Thomas Hardiman, 6th Circuit Judge Raymond Kethledge, 8th Circuit Judge Steve Colleton and Raymond Gruender, 10th Circuit Judge Neil Gorsuch, and Michigan Supreme Court Justice Joan Larson. You know the holidays are over when I'm already getting emails from conservatives about why Bill Pryor would be a terrible choice, Jim. But it's good to know that the list being looked at here is a lot different than the list that President Obama was looking at last year, and certainly a lot different than what Hillary Clinton would have been looking at.
We shouldn't put any carts before the horse. We don't know exactly who the nominees are going to be. Both those names that Trump mentioned earlier are high on the list. It's good to have that list of 10 or 11 names that Trump had issued earlier. I think what I find most pleasantly surprising about this is the recognition that the possibility of being not just one but two openings and the idea that you might have to handle them differently. Like Democrats might be slightly less – they're going to staunchly oppose any Trump nominee no matter what. But it's going to – to the extent of building public support or any fears of any wavering Republicans – you have an easier time replacing Scalia than you will replacing either Ginsburg or Kennedy or anyone seen as not one of the, for lack of a better term, conservative justices. Some would say strict constructionists. Some would say originalists. They're different terms, but basically, in short, the kind of justices we like. And I think the arrangement suggested in that Politico article makes a lot of sense to me. Whatever they end up shaking out, it feels like they have a good handle on what the dynamics of the Supreme Court fight are going to be. I don't think you'll end up with a Harriet Myers type situation, at least, knocking on wood. And, the Trump team seems to recognize this is going to be one of their biggest and most consequential legacies. And if you botch that, all of a sudden your presidency looks really differently. Ask Reagan and Bush about that. Actually, ask Reagan, Bush, or Bush about that, depending on the way we feel about John Roberts lately.
Yes, it always seems that ours are a little more iffy than the Democrats. I can't remember the last Democrat that turned out to not be the lockstep liberal that the president who nominated them was hoping to be. I think you'd have to go back to Whizzer White to get that. That's a Kennedy appointment over 50 years ago, because you look at Ginsburg, you look at Breyer, you look at Sotomayor, you look at Kagan. I don't think Jimmy Carter had a Supreme Court appointment, so then you got to go back to the Johnson administration. But between Souter and O'Connor and depending on the case, Justice Roberts, yeah, it's important that we get this one right, to say the least, and hopefully that will be the case. And whoever Trump is counseling on this and getting advice from is a good person. It's also worth noting, we haven't seen potential Supreme Court nominees strolling through the lobby of Trump Tower being paraded through, so that there's a little more decorum perhaps in the selection process.
Yeah, not the highest bar clear, although you know what? How do we know Kanye wasn't there for that interview?
Now, that would be something.
Where's the Associate Justice? Ah, he's on tour.
All right, on to the bad martini. And this really is bad because, as we've tried to point out, that as much as it is interesting what we found out in the John Podesta emails and the DNC emails, just because we learn more about Hillary Clinton, just because it potentially damaged her campaign, doesn't make Julian Assange a good guy at all, doesn't make WikiLeaks a valuable operation at all. And unfortunately, too many people on the right just don't seem to get that, including the man who's going to be sworn in on the west front of the Capitol in a couple of weeks. Double-headed bad martini here, starting with Trump. This is USA Today. When it comes to claims that Russia hacked Democratic officials during last year's election, President-elect Donald Trump is apparently taking the word of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange over that of U.S. intelligence officials. Quote, and this is a Trump tweet, Julian Assange said that a 14-year-old could have hacked Podesta. Why was DNC so careless? Also said Russians did not give him the info, Trump tweeted Wednesday. So Trump is just assuming that Assange is telling the truth here. Here's the even more troubling one. This is a Facebook message from Sarah Palin. To Julian Assange, I apologize. Please watch Sean Hannity's interview with Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, exposing the truth regarding the left having been oh so guilty of atrocious actions and attitudes of which they falsely accused others. The media collusion that hid what many on the left have been supporting is shocking. The important information that finally opened people's eyes to Democrat candidates and operatives would not have been exposed were it not for Julian Assange. I apologize for condemning Assange when he published my infamous and proven non-controversial, relatively boring emails years ago. As I said at the time of being targeted in my subsequent condemnation, though, the line must be drawn before our troops or innocent lives deserving protection would be put at risk as a result of published emails. Julian, I apologize. Sarah Palin. P.S. If you get the chance, catch the movie Snowden. That movie and Hannity's interview tonight are quite enlightening. Jim, sometimes revelations can be helpful in terms of the long-term debate on issues, but when in the world did we get to the point where the right thinks Julian Assange and Edward Snowden are heroes?
Well, actually, my first question, Greg, and this, people are going to take this as snide, but I'm in a snide mood today. So Palin knows Assange and Snowden are different guys, right?
I hope so.
Right? Okay, so here's the thing. She kind of alludes to that in her first comment on him. July 2010, WikiLeaks published the names of U.S. military informants in Afghanistan in the process of releasing 90,000 classified docs. And these guys had to scramble, and the Taliban said, we're going to target these people because they're helping the Americans. Greg, I don't know about you. I don't forgive that. I don't forget that. And I don't care if Julian Assange comes out and, you know, develops a cure for cancer. Maybe if he does that, I'll rethink my opinion of him, right? But in that case, that kind of a scenario, he's, you know, the entire history of Julian Assange, he's not pro-American. He's not a good guy. He's not on our side. So if he happens to expose stuff that, you know, embarrasses the Democratic Party, yeah, I'm not going to cry a lot of tears over it, but it doesn't suddenly make me change my mind on this. And now the really disturbing thing is the idea that, look, was Russia behind this hack? It certainly seems that way. Russia certainly seems to have enormous hacking capabilities, enormous cyber warfare capabilities, and they're not shy about using them. And you can look back to when the invasion of Georgia and how frequently, you know, electric systems and broadcasting systems and things like that end up going down when Russia decides they don't like you. Now, does this 100% proof that Russia's behind the DNC hack and the John Podesta hack? No, but it certainly seems likely. And if the intelligence community is pointing in that direction, I put my faith in the intelligence community. Julian Assange now is saying he's absolutely totally certain it was not a state party. Curious phrasing there. And then the next thing is that apparently, if I understand it correctly, when they set up WikiLeaks, the whole point was anonymous submission. That you could send a mission, you could send information to them, and Assange and WikiLeaks crowd could say, look, we're not disclosing our source because we don't know the source. So if that's the way WikiLeaks did this operate differently, Greg? Because all of a sudden WikiLeaks is, oh, we totally know this wasn't Russian intelligence. Okay. Although that changes, that's different from what you were saying earlier. So it is appalling to see Republicans who just, you know, because the first time Julian Assange does something that they like, they fall over him and ready to slobber all over him. And it's a a bizarre moral inversion, and a convenient amnesia. And it demonstrates that some folks on the right are extraordinarily cheap dates. You do them one favor and they will forgive anything. And, you know, it's not good for conservatives, not good for Republicans, not good for Americans, Greg.
Not at all. And that's a really good way to put it. We can see a lot of folks on the right be cheap dates sometimes. Of course, there's the Bradley Manning emails from Iraq. You mentioned the ones from Afghanistan and on and on and on. And guess what? As of January 20th, guess which party controls all the levers in Washington? So guess who has emails that can be hacked? And guess who has emails that can be passed along to WikiLeaks? And then all of a sudden we're going to hate Julian Assange again because of the circumstances, not because of who he is and what he does. All right.
He'll be back to being an enemy again then.
Yes, exactly right. All right, on to the crazy martini now. And once again, Democrats have a hard time understanding who's in charge and what power they have. This is courtesy of Ed O'Keefe over at the Washington Post. Democratic senators plan to aggressively target eight of Donald Trump's cabinet nominees in the coming weeks and are pushing to stretch their confirmation votes into March, an unprecedented break with Senate tradition. Such delays would upend Republican hopes of quickly holding hearings and confirming most of Trump's top picks on Inauguration Day. But Democrats, hamstrung by their minority status, are determined to slow walk Trump's picks unless they start disclosing reams of personal financial data they've withheld so far, according to senior aides. The only two, according to the story, who aren't going to be subject to this process are Mattis and Kelly, the two generals up for defense and homeland security, respectively. For everyone else, Chuck Schumer wants two full days of hearings and witnesses with unlimited rounds of questioning, apparently based on whether the minority wants to keep going or not. They also want enough spacing between hearings by multiple committees that it would take almost 2 months to confirm the incoming cabinet, two per week for 19 posts that have cabinet rank. Jim, who makes the rules?
I've never seen a Senate minority so pushy. A couple of thoughts. Yeah, of course you should have complete and total hearings. The vetting should be thorough. Every senator on every relevant committee should have the right to ask questions they want. You know, I myself really want to hear what Rex Tillerson has to say. I know the guy's been painted as a Putin stooge. I've also seen folks who I respect a great deal, the Condi Rice's of the world, saying he's a good guy, and heard some very interesting things about the character of Rex Tillerson. And he's a much more humble and decent guy than you might have pictured from a guy who's been in the highest heights of corporate America for a long time. So I want to know more about these cabinet nominees. I think there's a perfectly fair to ask questions. Having said that, when you're deliberately slowing it down just for the sake of slowing it down, I don't see the benefit to that either to the country, and I actually don't think it's actually going to help the Democrats that much either. I think it ask the Bush administration if the slow process and all kinds of sluggish problems there complicated anything in the first year of the Bush administration. Because, hey, what happened during the first year of the Bush administration? Any major foreign policy crises? The second thing about that, Greg, is that, look, if you want to argue about Tillerson, fine. Longtime listeners know my gripes with Ben Carson, although I HUD seems like such a disaster. It's hard to imagine he would do that much worse. That's the benefits of the low standards set by Julian Castro. But the bigger question is, if all eight are the worst ever, then none of them are the worst ever. You can't say that, DeVos is the worst, and Carson is the worst, and Tillerson is the worst, and Mad Dog Mattis is the worst. You just go down the list. Everyone, if you really want to, stop a Trump cabinet nominee, you need to focus, and you're not going to have the time and the public attention span to make the argument against eight folks simultaneously. The other thing that's really tough to do is a minority. The name of the game is to pick off nervous Republicans, the Susan Collinses of the world. Lindsey Graham and John McCain and Marco Rubio all sound a little wary about Tillerson. So maybe you could derail that one if you can really make the case that he's too friendly towards Putin. But Democrats can't do this. They can't prioritize this. And to them, the biggest problem about Tillerson is in the fossil fuel industry, not that he's too friendly to Putin. So they think this is going to help them with their base. I think this is I could see this backfiring on the Democrats pretty easily, and I would not be surprised if they end up going 0-for-8 when it comes to blocking Trump cabinet nominees.
Could very well be, thanks to their own rule change a few years ago where there is no filibuster now. And I love how the minority thinks they can determine how long the hearings last. As you said, they should be thorough, but that is ultimately up to the committee chair and so forth. Jim, I think it all goes back to how the conventional wisdom, particularly the media, responds to election results. If a Democrat wins, it's a mandate, and that's the way that the country needs to go. If a Republican wins, it's up to the Republicans to heal the divide.
It's all your fault.
All right, we're back in the swing of it. We'll keep it going tomorrow. See you, Jim.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and please join us again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.